On October 3, 1980, a bomb was detonated outside a synagogue on Köpernick Street in Paris. 3 decades later, French investigators finally identified a suspect in the case. A Lebanese-Canadian sociology professor living a quiet life on the outskirts of Ottawa, Canada. Is Hassan Diab guilty?
Can you introduce yourself?
Or is he a scapegoat?
Hassan Diab.
From Canada Land, this is The Köpernick Affair. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
In Germany, anti-immigrant rhetoric has taken hold, and there's an irony in that.
Germany's economic future very much depends on whether it is able to attract immigrants.
I'm Carol Hills. What Germans want out of Sunday's high-stakes election. Also, it's been almost 3 years since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Today, we hear the story of one Ukrainian in exile.
I was Ukrainian, I'm Ukrainian, and I will be Ukrainian for all my life. This feeling is permanent.
Tech giant Meta has plans for an undersea internet cable longer than the Earth's circumference.
It will connect large chunks of the world, which means it will travel across waters belonging to all kinds of countries. It's a massive undertaking.
Plus, origami shaping the future. That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. All eyes are on Europe right now. Transatlantic tensions are running high, and far-right ideologies once considered fringe are now gaining real political traction on the continent. A big vote in Germany this weekend could be an indication of where things are headed. This snap election was called late last year when Chancellor Olaf Scholz lost a parliamentary confidence vote, causing his government to collapse. His left-wing party is third place in the polls, leading the pack, center-right and far-right parties. To start today's show, The World's Orla Barry explains that for German voters getting ready to cast their ballots, 2 big issues loom large: the economy and immigration.
Voters on the streets of Berlin have wildly different opinions on the issue of immigration.
Die dürfen alle herkommen, aber sie sollten eine Arbeit aufnehmen und sich integrieren.
Everyone can come here, but they should get a job and integrate. Antje Butke tells my colleague Joshua Coe. Butke, who's 56, is a caregiver for people with dementia, and she's not impressed with the current government's migration policy. I'm sorry, but it's not good, she says, using more colourful language. Butke plans to vote for the far-right AfD party on Sunday. Jenna Bassessi, who's 47, sees things very differently. We need immigration, she says, so we can generate more skilled workers for the future. Germany can't do it alone, she says. This election campaign has been dominated by anti-migrant sentiment, a lot of it coming from the lawmakers themselves.
Das Maß ist endgültig voll. Wir stehen vor dem Scherbenhaufen.
We've reached a breaking point, Friedrich Merz said recently. He's the frontrunner to become the next German chancellor. We're faced with the shambles of an immigration policy for the past 10 years, he said. Merz is calling for Germany's borders to be closed to undocumented migrants. The far-right AfD party is calling for mass deportations. For some in Berlin, all this rhetoric is hard to listen to.
Ich bin 2015 nach Deutschland gekommen. Das war eine schwierige, sozusagen,
Tarek Alaus says he arrived in Germany in 2015. He fled the Assad regime in Syria for political and religious reasons. Alaus arrived at a time when the German government was rolling out the welcome mat to Syrian asylum seekers.
All weekend, tens of thousands of migrants arrived in Germany to the one thing they wanted most, a warm welcome.
That famous welcome in 2015 was mainly from Germans on the ground, Alaus says, not the politicians in the Bundestag. Today, Alaus is a German citizen and works with Pro Asyl, a refugee rights group.
Die Menschen haben große Angst und viele Menschen überlegen auszuwandern. Man muss aber auch an
People are very afraid, he says. Many refugees are thinking about emigrating altogether. Economic experts say all this saber-rattling about closing borders will do little to solve the real problem the country faces.
Germany has had now 3 years of economic stagnation, so the economy is basically at zero growth.
Marcel Fratscher heads up the German Institute for Economic Research in Berlin. If the German government really wants to yank the economy up off its knees, he says, it needs migrants.
With the demographic shift, more and more baby boomers retiring, Germany's economic future very much depends on whether it is able to attract immigrants, not just highly qualified engineers, but also along all skill levels over the coming 10 to 15 years.
Much of Germany's economic identity is wrapped up in factories, in particular the automotive industry. But Fratscher says German car makers failed to innovate as quickly as their rivals. In China, for example, Germany was also hugely dependent on Russian gas. So when Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022, energy prices soared. Now there's a new threat.
Am I going to impose tariffs on the European Union? You want the truthful answer, or should I give you a political answer? Absolutely.
President Trump's recent comments have rattled German industries.
There are very, very strong fears about that, because the US is something like 10, 12, 13% of the German exports.
Gabriela Abels is European politics professor at Tübingen University.
Just raising tariffs for German automobiles or for steel would make German exports much more expensive in the US, and that would have a dramatic effect here on the German economy.
Back on the streets of Berlin, some German voters are pragmatic about what needs to happen now.
This is a schwere Zeit. We müssen da durch, aber es gibt immer
sowas. It's a difficult time, engineer Pravin Sievi says. But we have to get through this. Sievi, who works in the automotive industry, says now Germany has to play catch-up. Some voters, like Ricky Weber, just want more stability.
Dass wir eine stabile Regierung bekommen, nicht wie die letzte, das konnte man eigentlich schon vorab wissen.
We need a more stable and effective government, he says. And then he says something that's been on the minds of many here in the EU this past week.
Insgesamt hoffe ich einfach nur, dass in Europa der Frieden wieder
einzieht. I just hope that peace returns to Europe, he says, and that the next German government works hard to ensure that this wretched war in Ukraine finally comes to an end. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Sometimes in sports, it's just a game. But last night's hockey match at Boston's TD Garden was a whole lot more than that. Some of the best hockey players in the U.S. went up against a powerhouse lineup from Canada. It was the final game in a new round-robin-style competition called the Four Nations Face-Off. The four nations in question are the United States and Canada, plus Sweden and Finland. The North American rivals first met last Saturday in Montreal. Canadians booed the Star-Spangled Banner. Pretty harsh, although recent words from Washington probably had more than a little to do with it.
So I think Canada is going to be a very serious contender to be our 51st state.
Team USA won that game, which ramped up the rivalry heading into last night's matchup in Boston. Canadian singer Chantal Kreviazuk sang her country's national anthem, drawing boos from the Boston crowd. And by the way, she changed a line of O Canada.
That only us command.
That only us command. So, a statement on sovereignty there. The game itself was a nail-biter. The teams went into overtime for a jaw-dropping finish. Here it is on Canadian broadcaster Sportsnet.
And off the drop, and David went forward and nearly got a shot on. McCarr sends it around. Marner waiting. Connor McDavid scores! Connor McDavid for Canada!
The CBC reported from a bar in Nova Scotia watching the game.
When that puck went in the net, this room roared. People were on their feet. They were on their tables. They were on their chairs. They were hugging their friends.
As Team Canada collected its medals, Boston fans started filing out of the stadium. But not Brian Babbs of Massachusetts, who got downright philosophical when he talked to GBH last night in Boston.
At the end of the day, we're brothers, we're sisters, we're together, we're human beings. It doesn't matter the political side of it, we're all enjoying sports.
Perhaps the biggest winner last night was hockey, the sport. Lots of new fans tuned in for the high-stakes game. Longtime hockey lovers were watching, too. And all looking ahead to the 2026 Winter Olympics in Italy, where Team Canada and Team USA could well face off again. Out on the streets of Tokyo, the sight of someone pushing a stroller is pretty common. But look inside the stroller, and instead of a baby, you'll often see a well-groomed, four-legged companion. Turns out that's emblematic of a larger trend. Rebecca Rossman brings us the story from Tokyo.
This growling dog is actually very sweet. This is just how she plays with her favorite squeaky toy. Her name is Peoplesham. She's a gray and white bearded Shih Tzu who is adored by her 33-year-old owner, Kako Sada. Sada tells me when they met in a Tokyo pet shop 6 years ago, it was love at first sight. Something just clicked, she says. Peoplesham was different from all the other dogs, off in the corner, doing her own thing. She thought, what a weirdo. She knew she had to bring her home. Since then, Sada says her entire routine has changed. She wakes up earlier, gets out of the house more to take Peoplesham on walks. She says she feels more responsible. Maybe this sounds familiar. For many people around the world today, pets aren't just animals, they're family. And Sada is no exception. She says Peoplesham is a mix of her child, her family, and her best friend. But at the end of the day, she's still a dog. And I like that, she says. There are things we can't share because we're different species. And that's part of the beauty of our relationship. The idea of pets as family is driving a massive industry in Japan. Luxury pet boutiques, dog-friendly cafes, and high-end pet food brands are thriving. One of those brands is Pet Cook, founded by 26-year-old Sarah Shimonaka. Shimonaka tells me she started Pet Cook after her dog, Yukichi, stopped eating. His coat lost its shine and he had digestion problems, she says. That's when I started looking at the ingredients and realized a lot of pet food isn't good for pets at all. After years of research, she launched Pet Cook, selling $6 a bag human-grade pet food in stores across Japan. She even opened a dog-friendly cafe where humans and dogs share afternoon tea sets. Pets in Japan are increasingly treated like children, and it's not cheap. Some people spend hundreds, even thousands of dollars a month on their dogs, Shimonaka says. But is this trend tied to Japan's declining birth rate? Tokyo-based sociologist Barbara Holthus is working on a book about the role of pets in contemporary Japan.
I mean, if you just count new dogs and new cats that were brought into Japanese homes, there were 766,000 new cats and dogs in 2023. Children born in the same year were 727,000.
Japan's overall pet ownership remains low compared to other parts of the world. Just over 20% of households own a pet, compared to nearly 60% in the U.S. Still, pet ownership is on the rise in Japan. And as birth rates plummet, young couples, especially in cities, are choosing pets over children. Hothu says financial strain is a major reason.
I think it's not necessarily that people don't want a child. A pet is cheaper, and a pet also provides a certain degree of emotional support.
Many working mothers in Japan also face discrimination, and long hours make parenting difficult. Pets offer companionship without the pressure of raising a child, Holtus says. When I ask Kako Sada about this, she nods in agreement. If Japan were a better place to raise kids, maybe more people would choose to have them, she says. Before I leave Sada's apartment, I notice a hand-drawn portrait she has proudly displayed on her entry table. Sada is cradling people like a baby. They both look happy, protected, and loved, grateful to have each other. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman, Tokyo.
You're with the world. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. The tech giant Meta just announced a plan to link 5 continents to the internet with 1 very long undersea cable. The cable in question would stretch across 30,000 miles of the ocean floor. 30,000 miles. That's longer than the Earth's circumference. Meta's calling the plan Project Waterworth. It will cost billions, and it raises serious security questions. Elizabeth Braw joined us today to talk about those challenges. She's a senior fellow with the Atlantic Council's Transatlantic Security Initiative. And she told us Meta's plan would go way beyond what's already in place.
The current system is that you have lots of shorter cables connecting 2 places. You also have a number of longer cables connecting several places. So you can have, for example, transatlantic cables that connect the UK with New England, where you are now. Then you have other cables that connect several countries, but countries that are closer together. But 50,000 kilometers would be a first. And also the fact it aims to connect several continents that are far apart. And this that makes it particularly fascinating. And I think both from an engineering perspective, but also from a geopolitics perspective, because who knows what the relations will be between the different countries of the world when this project is finished.
So the vast majority of data shared internationally over the web, it's already connected via undersea cables. How do they work?
So the cables that we have today that connects us, essentially allow the internet and other communications to function, are fiber optic cables. They are the most modern version of cables on the seabed. And it is glass fibers at the core of those cables that transmit the information that we send every single second of every single day. And this is very sensitive technology. If you damage it, the cables can no longer transmit that information, which is why it has several layers of protection surrounding those glass fibers that form the core and that transmits the information.
Now, as you know, there's been damage to these undersea cables, some intentional, some not. What are Meta's plans to protect this giant long undersea cable?
Well, I should start by saying that the way undersea cables are put on the seabed is that many are put there with a sort of an additional security arrangement, which is that the company laying the cable then adds sand and stone crush on top of it to make sure that it's essentially buried under the seabed. And that's what Meta says it will have in an improved way. I'm not sure how much better its planned protection will be compared to what already exists. But I think given the realities today, you do have to have a protective layer of sand and stone crush on top of undersea infrastructure to reduce the risk of harm to that cable or whatever it is you have on the seabed. Because what we've seen is that there are countries and actors willing to harm that undersea infrastructure. Those activities have been taking place mostly in Taiwanese waters and in the Baltic Sea. But undersea cables and electricity interconnectors and pipelines are at risk anywhere.
So what are the benefits, then, of connecting the world this way? It sounds like it's going to be risky and difficult to maintain. Is the technology they're proposing just so much better that it's kind of worth it? What's your sense of that?
We don't know exactly what their technology is. And in particular, we don't know what their thinking is around the risk to the entire cable if there is damage to one section of the cable. I would love to know that. And I suspect, though, that they won't release any details for fear of essentially getting potential perpetrators interested in damaging the cable just to show that it can be done. So I think for Meta, this is really just a flagship project. Meta wants to show that it's the best in the world in different ways, including having the longest cable in the world and essentially also a little bit outflanked its Silicon Valley tech rivals.
Elizabeth Braw is a senior fellow with the Atlantic Council's Transatlantic Security Initiative. Alberto Fernandez was president of Argentina from 2019 to 2023. He referred to himself as the first feminist of Argentina. Fernandez created the Ministry of Women to crack down on perpetrators of domestic violence. Now that's the very crime he's accused of committing. A judge ruled this week that the former president will stand trial on charges of domestic violence. He's accused of beating his partner, then First Lady Fabiola Yáñez. Fernandez has denied the accusation. Buenos Aires journalist Karen Naundorf told The World's Carolyn Beeler what the former president is being charged with.
The charges focus on one incident in June 21, when he supposedly punched Yanis in the eye at the presidential residence. And the other one was in August 21, when he again supposedly grabbed her hard enough to leave bruises. So it's not about a long history, it's about two documented cases.
These charges were first levied last August, and now a judge has just now said that the former president must stand trial. Do we know why?
Yes, the judge decided to move forward because of the evidence that popped up in a totally different investigation, one about corruption. And then investigators found messages and photos on the phone of Fernandez's secretary, Maria Cantero, that hinted at domestic violence. And once that came out, Fabiola Yanis officially filed a complaint, and the judge concluded that there were sufficient grounds to proceed with a trial.
What other evidence came out in the months that the judge spent researching these charges?
I think the most important evidence are some pictures. The pictures are really heavy stuff. You can see the bruises. You have several pictures, and there's one with that can really observe a right eye with a really blue violet bruise.
So a black eye and other bruises.
Yeah, it's definitely a black eye.
Fabiola Yanis has spoken about this case. What has she said?
Fabiola Yanis formally filed the complaint in August 24, and she accused Fernandez of physical and psychological abuse during their relationship. She has described feeling controlled and intimidated, and in this context, she called his behavior as a form of psychological terrorism.
And she and Fernandez are no longer together, I gather. Where is she now?
She is currently residing in Madrid, Spain, with her son. She moved there after the presidency ended, and she has been talking about the case from abroad.
I want to go to President Fernandez's record here for a second. In a 2022 speech on International Women's Day, then-President Fernandez said, "I'm ashamed that in Argentina women suffer from gender violence." He also called himself, as we've said, the first feminist of Argentina. Back when he was president, did the women of Argentina see him that way too? Like, did he actually have that reputation?
Yeah, you really have a reputation. It was not just the positioning. I can tell you from my reporting, I'm a journalist, and I've been doing documentaries on femicide. And for example, the parents of a murdered girl, they were received by him in the Casa Rosada, in the government building. And the mother told Fernandez that she was afraid because the murder of her daughter was a policeman. And right away, Fernandez personally ordered police protection for her. And he was also the first president of Argentina to take the law Micaela seriously. This is a law providing for a mandatory training and gender issues for all civil servants, including teachers, judicial staff, security forces, and for presidents. And on his first day in office, Fernandez took part in this training, which lasted several hours. So everything that is happening now is very disappointing for the feminist movement in Argentina.
Karen Naundorf is a journalist based in Buenos Aires. She's been speaking there with The World's Carolyn Beeler. You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. We're coming up on a somber anniversary, 3 years since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. It's been the deadliest war in Europe since World War II, and millions of Ukrainians have been displaced. The World's Daniel Offman brings us a story of one young Ukrainian man's escape.
3 years ago, just a few weeks before the full-scale invasion, I visited a small town in northeast Ukraine called Vovchansk. At the time, tens of thousands of Russian troops were amassing near Ukraine's border. There was concern that something might happen, but no one yet knew the scope of the Kremlin's plans. If an invasion were to happen, Vovchansk would be especially vulnerable, since it's located in the Kharkiv region, just a few miles from the Russian border.
In large measure, this situation is heating up especially among the older generation.
In the center of town, I met a 20-year-old man named Basha. He says older folks are scared. Some grannies are running to the store buying groceries and matches. But he says younger people like him aren't concerned. This isn't the first time people have warned that there could be a bigger war, he says. Half of my family is Ukrainian and the other half is Russian. How can you have a conflict like that within one family? I feel Ukrainian, though. Even though I mostly speak Russian, I wouldn't want to be part of Russia. After talking to Pasha, we followed each other on Instagram and went our separate ways. In the 3 years since that conversation, I hadn't spoken with him until this week. I learned his full name is Pavlo Syry. Pasha is a nickname. He told me a bit about his life before the war.
I had a lot of hobbies, like searching for old things in the forest with a metal detector, like ride a bike. I had a full life there in Ukraine, and I had a lot of friends. My life was full of energy and full of interesting moments until the Russian full-scale invasion.
Pasha says that when the full-scale invasion began, Russia's military shelled the outskirts of Vovchansk. He and his family fled to his grandparents' home in a small village about 20 miles south of Vovchansk. Soon, though, they began running out of food and fuel. During a drive to a nearby gas station, they witnessed a Russian aerial attack. Pasha says that's the moment he decided to flee. When talking to me, he says he feels more comfortable fully expressing himself in Russian.
И когда мы приняли решение ехать в Россию, сначала в Россию, а после в Европу.
At first, he wanted to go to Kharkiv, Ukraine's second biggest city. But he soon learned that all the roads to Kharkiv were cut off by Russian troops. So he and some friends decided to head north towards the Russian border. His highly risky plan was to escape the war by taking a circuitous journey through Russia.
Это очень страшно и холодно вспоминать.
Pasha says it's a very cold and frightening feeling just to remember those moments. He says he watched as Russian tanks and armored vehicles rolled into Ukraine in the dark of night. Behind him, Vovchansk, his hometown, was dark, he says. The electricity was shut off. The Russian towns up ahead were still bright. Pasha says that at the border, he was interrogated for at least 2 hours.
Все вопросы, которые они задавали,
they asked questions based on Russian propaganda, he says. They asked, do you have Nazis in Ukraine? How many have you seen? And are you allowed to speak Russian in Ukraine? Eventually, he was allowed to cross into Russia, but he had no desire to stay there. He wanted to make his way to the EU, but he was strapped for cash. All he had was about $150. Pasha says that distant Russian relatives and friends helped him along the way. Eventually, after traveling hundreds of miles north, Pasha crossed yet another border into Latvia, leaving Russia behind.
Это было 6 марта 2022 года. Это мой день рождения.
It was March 6, 2022. It was my birthday, and this was the best birthday gift the world could have given me, he says. That feeling of freedom, that all my fears are behind me, is the best feeling I've ever had. In the 3 years since fleeing Russia and Ukraine, Pasha's life has completely changed. He now lives in Switzerland and works in construction. He says that over these years, he's lost his entire former life, including his best friend, Vladislav, who was killed in a Russian artillery attack. For a long time, he says, he held out hope that one day he'd return to Vovchansk. But now, he says, that would be impossible.
Волчанск уничтожен полностью, и Волчанск более сильно разрушен, чем Сталинград.
Vovchansk, he says, is completely destroyed. It's more destroyed than Stalingrad was during World War II. News reports show Vovchansk is now a frontline city and a ghost town. Ukrainian troops are in the southern part of the city, and Russia is in the north. The center of town is a battleground obliterated by artillery fire.
Конечно, мечта жить в Украине, она выглядит как утопия.
The dream of living in Ukraine again, Pasha says, feels utopian. He says he would love to live in a peaceful Ukraine, with no war or death, like in the rest of the civilized world. He calls that a childish desire. Now he says he looks at his life as if it's a movie. He says no author could have come up with a story like this. Pasha says he likes his new life in Europe. He's thankful to have a job and the support of the Swiss government. But at the end of the day, he says,
I was Ukrainian, I'm Ukrainian, and I will be Ukrainian for all my life. And this feeling is permanent.
For the world, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
A 500,000 Haitians in the U.S. will lose what's called temporary protected status, or TPS. It's part of President Trump's larger overhaul of the U.S. immigration system. Many of the people affected by this latest move are Haitians who came to the U.S. in the aftermath of the massive earthquake in 2010. Some came as refugees, while others entered the U.S. illegally at the time, but were granted temporary protected status that allowed them to stay. TPS for Haitians was then extended under the Biden administration. But now that status is slated to end in August. Daniel Foote is a former U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti.
TPS is granted to citizens of a country that has had an ongoing armed conflict, an environmental disaster, or extraordinary temporary conditions. And once those conditions are determined to be gone, those people who were in the States without coming in through a port of entry and seeing our Customs and Border Protection people, they no longer have legal status in the United States and they are no longer able to work legally.
So is the idea that if you lose TPS, are you escorted out of the country or you're simply vulnerable to being deported? How does it actually work?
Much more vulnerable to being deported. During most of my career, my 25-year career, in many of the countries like Haiti, we do deport to those countries, but almost strictly released criminals.
So what are people in Haitian communities across the U.S. talking about and worrying about right now?
I mean, they're terrified. Most of them have escaped either this horrific environmental disaster of an earthquake, which I've never seen anything as devastating in my life, and I spent a long time in Iraq and in Afghanistan. The possibility of going back to Haiti at this point for many of these people is unthinkable. Haiti cannot support or secure the people it has right now. It's that bad. 6,000-some people were killed in gang violence last year. It's really difficult. So people who have been living in suburban towns, working in factories, putting roofs on places, and the U.S. Haitian families now have to consider the fact that they may have to go back to Port-au-Prince or wherever they're from in Haiti.
Describe the conditions on the ground in Haiti at the moment.
Horrific. It has steadily eroded from July of 2021, when the last president of Haiti, Jovenel Moïse, was assassinated under a series of U.S. appointed, anointed leaders who have done nothing to tackle the gang problem. The gangs are basically running Haiti. Schools are closed. Hospitals have difficulty getting fuel for generators and things like that. It's still a very difficult situation where the people are living like the people in Khartoum, Sudan. They're just hunkered down in their homes and they only leave for absolute necessities.
Is there any sense that conditions in Haiti will be any better by August of this year when TPS is set to expire?
Absolutely not. The part of TPS that hasn't been undertaken in this instance is the U.S. government needs to do an assessment and say, okay, Haiti is now okay to receive people. It has the social structure and the government administration and stuff. Nobody's done that.
What does this mean for Haiti? I mean, presumably a large number of people returning could be difficult for the country to absorb. Is there any sense of how that's going to work?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a further tinder on the fire that is Haiti right now. It's going to create more immigration. We think that sending them back to Haiti is going to stop the problem. It doesn't address the drivers of migration, which are poor security, poverty, lack of opportunity, lack of education, etc. And so by creating another desperate group of refugees and then sending them back to one of the most violent places on earth in Port-au-Prince, it's just going to create people turning back around and trying to come back here, except they'll do it in more risky manners on rickety old boats across the Caribbean, etc. I also think it has the potential to increase illicit trafficking of arms, drugs, people, and heaven knows what else out of Haiti, which currently is the illicit trafficking capital of this hemisphere. There's no question about it, which will further erode U.S. security. The Trump administration is moving with such alacrity that these people may be in Haiti by the time you get restraining orders and stuff. So there is a chance that legal challenges will pose hurdles and could halt this, but this rock is moving downhill right now.
Daniel Foote is a former U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti. It's the art of folding paper into basically any shape you can imagine. A star, a delicate crane, a lotus flower, or a dragon. Origami started thousands of years ago in Japan. But as the world's Bianca Hillier reports, even an ancient practice can continue to evolve.
Robert Lang's origami designs can take weeks, months, and even years to create. He works out of his home studio in Altadena, California, which is part of Los Angeles. Most recently, Lang, one of the most celebrated origami artists of the past few decades, designed a piece called Triangulated Snub Dodecahedron Dollar Module, Opus 874. Put simply,
it's a sphere that's folded from 210 $1 bills.
Sadly, that piece and much of his life's work are now gone. In the early morning hours of January 8th, Lang watched as his origami studio went up in flames during the devastating LA fires.
About 1:30 in the morning, we drove up to the corner of the evacuation zone so I could see what my studio was like. And while I watched, it caught. And I have a few minutes of video of the last moments of my studio. And so, you know, I watched it burn and, of course, knowing what all was in there.
Lang says, in theory, he can refold any of his own figures because he has the design saved. What he's most sad about are the works he had by other artists.
Well, one of them was a pelican folded by the great Japanese master Akira Yoshizawa.
Akira Yoshizawa is considered the grandmaster or father of modern origami. He died on his 94th birthday in 2005.
So that was very precious to me.
The fire also burned years of letters between Lang and other origami artists that were a sort of historical record. As the origami community grapples with this loss, a portion of the field is also charting the future of origami.
Okay, so now we're going to bring all the corners together.
Brendan Wong has been making origami since he was a little kid, and he teaches me how to fold a simple crane.
All right, so now you want to fold it to the center line?
Wong is a senior at MIT, and he credits origami for his career choice.
I chose mechanical engineering because of, like, origami. There's a lot of engineering applications of origami. So that's kind of why I chose engineering, because it seemed like the most likely route for origami to come up again later.
Wong is far from alone in connecting those dots. Today, origami buffs are almost as likely to be mathematicians and engineers as they are to be traditional artists.
Only a few people, a few very smart people, they do buffs.
Zeng Yu is a professor of engineering science at Oxford University. He says origami techniques are being used in industries like robotics and aerospace. Medical devices, airbags, telescopes, and emergency response tools are all being developed using folded origami techniques. Most of them remain in the conceptual and research stages. Zeng says engineers like himself are inspired by the ancient art form, and he adds that's a trend as old as time.
It's kind of part of our civilization. It's all started with kind of curiosity, you know, why they see works like that. And then gradually you will find that lots of this stuff can be very useful. It's just early days, people didn't realize they have practical use.
Oh, I think it's fantastic.
Robert Lang again.
Engineers have tapped into a new vein of their toolkit. by being able to look at the patterns that origami artists, people have developed and say, I can use that somewhere.
Lang says origami's transformation from art to science has also led to a shift in how it's viewed. Though mathematicians have long written about origami, those scholars were generally brushed off because origami was seen as just a child's toy.
And the fact that it has started to have real-world applications and useful applications in things like medicine and space has kind of given the academic world of origami a bit of respectability.
Keiko Nozaki hopes that newfound respect will make its way back to everyday adults in Japan. She grew up there and learned origami in elementary school. But when she got older, she and her classmates stopped folding.
Generally, most of the children stop origami when they grow up. I haven't been folding origami
for a while.
That's her 7-year-old son, Tomomi, chiming in. He started folding a few years ago, which got mom back into it, too. The family now lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
When I came here, I'm really surprised that everyone loves origami, even though they're adult.
Nozaki hopes origami's use in STEM fields keeps advancing, in part so that adults back home in Japan can continue their beloved pastime without judgment. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. The Trump administration has deported many migrants who entered the U.S. illegally to Central America. That includes people from Iran, India, China. Migrants' rights groups are concerned about how the deportees are being treated, and they say the U.S. is offloading its own legal obligation onto other countries. The Royal Shirin Jafari reports.
محدثه سادات قاسمی پور پستید دیس ویدیو آنلاین لاست فرایدی.
هممون هنوز دستبندامون به دستمون هست.
She's sitting on a bed in a hotel room. Five others are on the bed with her. One of them is a teenager.
فقط به ما کمک بکنید. نه پولی داریم نه چیزی. ما نه سیم کارت داریم.
قاسمی پور described how she and about 100 migrants had recently entered the US without authorization, but they intended to apply for asylum. They were taken to a detention camp in San Diego, and a few days later, they were shackled and put on a military plane. She says the guards didn't tell them where they were going. They had no idea they would end up in Panama. Please help us, she says in the video. There are children among us. We have no money, and we can't leave our hotel room unless accompanied by a security guard. When I reached Qasemi Pour a few hours later on the phone, she described why she had left her home country of Iran a few months before. She said she had a court case against her because she took part in anti-government protests. Through coughs, Qasemi Pour said she had converted to Christianity from Islam 3 years ago. That's a crime punishable by death in Iran. I was searching for freedom, she said. Freedom of thought, freedom to do anything I want, and to be who I really am. In recent weeks, the Trump administration has sent military planes full of migrants to countries like Panama, Costa Rica, and Honduras. This is part of its efforts to curb unlawful entry to the U.S., as promised by President Trump during his campaign. Muzaffar Chishti is a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute. He says these deportations happened under the Biden administration as well, as part of the Third Country Agreement.
Under which we send migrants to other countries who are not nationals of that country, and that country then takes responsibility removing them.
But the migrants who have been deported to Panama say they haven't been allowed to meet with lawyers. Some of them have agreed to be sent back to their country of origin, but the rest have been moved to camps near the Darien jungle. They're no longer reachable by phone. Susana Sabalsa is a Panamanian lawyer who has been trying to represent a family of three from Taiwan who are seeking political asylum. We've been denied access to meet them, she says. They don't want to return to their country because they will face persecution. Ibrahim Kazalqalchi was also at the hotel in Panama earlier this week. I have no doubt I will be hanged if I return to Iran, he told me on Tuesday. Kazalqalchi said he too had converted to Christianity and took part in the anti-government protests in 2022. He said the security forces broke his hands and hit him in the mouth with a rifle. He lost some of his teeth and spent 9 months in prison, he said. He fled the country with his wife and two teenagers. They made several stops before arriving in Mexico. From Tapachula to Mexico City, they hitched a ride on a cargo train. They sat on top of a train car for 12 hours, he said, worried about the kids falling off. He tied them together with a rope. After we spoke, Gazalkachi was also taken to a camp near the Darien jungle. I haven't been able to reach him again.
Those reception centers are used for people who have come out of the Darien Gap and are seeking like very rudimentary emergency humanitarian assistance.
Rachel Schmidtke is senior advocate for Latin America at Refugees International. She says the camps are not set up for long-term stay. Her organization has accused the governments of Panama and Costa Rica of helping the U.S. violate human rights. Under international conventions, the U.S. is required to allow asylum seekers to make their case.
What we're most concerned about is that people who have a well-founded fear of persecution are being returned to a place where they could potentially be face very serious harm or be killed.
A spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security said that the migrants deported to Panama were in the United States illegally. She said none of them had said that they fear going back and that they were, quote, properly removed from the country. Muzaffar Chishti of the Migration Policy Institute says the U.S. has effectively outsourced its obligations regarding asylum seekers to other countries.
The major difference between Trump 1 and Trump 2, as far as I can see it from deportations, is the extraordinary willingness of foreign countries to be participants in this global machinery on deportation. Reasonable minds can, you know, disagree on causes of people to leave. But we hope we can all agree that human beings are entitled to basic dignity.
The Embassy of Panama in Washington didn't respond to questions about the deportations. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Here's a new type of music in the ever-expanding world of musical genres. Creole Afrofuturism. That's what the French band Dodeline calls this upbeat style of music, mixing up Creole, soul, jazz, electronica, and dance. What a beat. Dodeline's lyrics are also a fusion of French, Creole, and English, which you can hear in this song called Something's Going On. Something's going on, it doesn't ever matter. The band's name, Dodeline, comes from a Creole word meaning slow and idle. But the band's trajectory has been the exact opposite since they launched their debut album in 2018. The four musicians in Dodeline first got together in Lyon, France. It was vocalist Olivia Victorin who really brought the Afro-Caribbean vibes to the forefront. Victorin was born on the island of Martinique, then grew up in France. She said that musically, she didn't want to have to choose between what she calls the country of her birth and the country of her origin. So Dodeline blends the various sounds together. And that is Creole Afrofuturism. The band's latest album is Chanbe. In West Indian Creole, that means hold on. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend and join us right back here on Monday.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, by the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Tina Cole and Mark Larson, Anne and John Newman, Eugene G. Park, Sharon G. and Robert L. Ryan. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.